Okay, so last time we introduced the concept of a conservative scheme, and I just copied the definition again here. Essentially, we define a scheme to be conservative if it satisfies, if it's essentially of this form given here, where U is approximates essentially the volume average of our solution, and G approximates the physical flux at the cell interfaces during time step delta t. So maybe I let me switch back here to what we wrote down last time. So just to recap, so essentially the idea is that our discrete function, our discrete solution approximates the actual solution. So the volume average of the actual solution in a given grid cell at a given time, while this numerical flux G is a function that tries to approximate this integral over the flux at the interface. So essentially, it sort of approximates the time average of the flux function, of the physical flux function of the actual equation, over a time step delta t. And so the different conservative schemes differ in how they exactly approximate these integrals. So in deriving and motivating the form of conservative scheme, I was explicitly writing down equal signs here. But really what we think, how we think about these quantities is that these discrete function values UIN and this discrete numerical flux only approximate these integrals. And so different conservative schemes differ in the way they approximate these integrals. And so they can have different properties. And so before I wanted to go on with sort of more material on convergence and entropy condition, I want to just to illustrate this a little bit and give you a few examples and point out a few crucial things about conservative schemes. So there are, and I think Eric raised that question last time. So there are actually a few very straightforward ways of how you can write down such a numerical flux function to get a conservative scheme, say for a scalar conservation law, for example. So let's look at this. So some straightforward choices for the numerical flux . So let's, for simplicity, focus on scalar conservation laws. Would be the following. So I'll just make a little table here. So on the left, I'll just write down the numerical flux function G. And on the right hand side, I'll write down what sort of this flux difference term here on the right hand side of the scheme would look like. So this is gi plus 1/2 n minus gi minus 1/2 n. So this was the notation that we set for the expression here on the right hand side. So as you remember, the numerical flux function needs to satisfy essentially two criteria, two general criteria. It has to be consistent, so meaning that we were demanding that in the case that both vectors are identical, we actually need to recover the physical flux function. And then the second requirement was that this function is Lipschitz continuous, which was an important property that we needed for the Lux-Wendorf theorem to make sure that it actually converges, that the scheme actually converges to a weak solution of the conservation law. And so obvious choices to satisfy these conditions are the following. So for example, we can write down, we could say, okay, G of U and V is just given by the physical flux applied to U. That is obviously consistent. And it's Lipschitz continuous as long as F, the physical flux, is Lipschitz continuous. And so if we plug that definition in, then we get the following formula on the right-hand side of our scheme. And you'll see this is just a backward finite difference sort of expression for our flux function. Now we can also define this numerical flux. And if you plug this in, we'll get a forward difference approximation to our flux function. And then finally, another very straightforward choice would be to simply take the average of the two above, and guess what we get? Anyone want to guess?
Centered.
Correct. So we'll get a center difference scheme. So actually, two delta x. And so in all cases, these flux functions satisfy the two conditions. They are consistent, they are Lipschitz continuous. So we can actually interpret some of these conservative schemes as essentially backward, forward, or central differences, approximations to our flux function. However, where we interpret the function u, the function values, the discrete function values ui, not as in the typical way as with finite differences, but actually as volume averages over cells. So it looks like a finite difference scheme, but it's actually not. So it's just a reinterpretation of those quantities appearing in such expressions. So we can interpret these simple conservative schemes backward, forward, and centered difference schemes. Oops. With UIN approximating volume averages.
So Daniel, so whether UIN is you know interpreted as approximating a volume average or interpreted as a you know at the value at a certain lattice site. Mm-hmm. Does it make a difference? I mean, so the scheme is a finite difference scheme regardless of the interpretation.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So you're asking whether that makes a difference in practice?
Right.
Yes. So in principle, not. So you can you can think of these discrete function values as volume averages or as just point-like approximations to the function. In principle, it does not make a big difference. So you will find that so essentially you can rewrite some of the finite differencing schemes as conservative schemes with that sort of new interpretation in terms of volume averages if you want, and they will have this conservative property. And so And so they can converge to the weak solution of the conservation law. So that is perfectly fine. And in fact, any of those can in principle. So we'll actually see that the second one does not, and with the third one does not, and with a slight modification, we can actually make this one to converge to the weak solution, and to also converge to the entropy solution of the conservation law. So yes, it's true. Finite differencing schemes can be some finite differencing schemes can be reinterpreted as finite volume schemes that are conservative and have the right properties. However, many of these simple finite differencing schemes often come with a lot of drawbacks, which is why you would not like to use them in practice if you're actually looking for genuinely discontinuous solutions. So some of them, and I'll point this out actually in a minute, you'll get a lot of numerical viscosity, for example, that smears out all discontinuities. And so you will not capture shocks properly and things like that. So these are the drawbacks.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So depending on essentially on our signal speed, F prime, you know, one or two can be unstable actually. So they violate, they can violate the CFL condition. So for example, if the signal speed is positive, right? And we take forward differences. I think we discussed this at length at one of the lectures, but also in the office hours. The numerical domain of dependence does not include the actual domain of dependence of the PDE, and so it violates the CFL condition and cannot be convergent. So depending on what the flux function does, one has to be very careful with the first two schemes, and one has to apply them properly depending on the solution and depending on the flux function. Now that can be sort of mitigated to some extent by using by using central differences, where you make sure that you can at least in principle include the numerical, that so that the numerical domain of dependence, which extends in plus and minus X region, can in principle contain the true domain of dependence of the equation, but that also turns out to be unstable, at least in general. If you do a simple von Neumann analysis, sort of going back to the linear case, so in general you can also not expect that scheme to be stable, but there's a interesting modification I wanted to point out you can make to get a stable method, and that is the famous Lex Friedrichs method. And that is still a fairly simple method that already essentially satisfies most of the things that we actually want. So with a slight modification of three, we can actually get a stable conservative scheme . So we'll just replace UIN on the right-hand side of our scheme expression here by an average, namely the following one. So we'll just say this is 1/2 UI minus 1N plus UI plus 1N. So we'll make it a centered sort of average. And so the resulting scheme would then look like the following. So we'll have here this replacement. And this again exemplifies how very small changes in numerical scheme can have a dramatic effect on its properties. And then again, we have the center differences for the flux terms in the second term. Now, you can look at actually this term here, and let's write this, let's rewrite this a little more. So we can also express this as UIN. We can just add zero to this expression. And then we get the following expression. Oh, I'm sorry, this should be plus ui minus 1 n. And so you'll recognize that this part here essentially approximates a second spatial derivative of u in a finite differencing manner. So this would be something like delta x times uxx. And so here we have essentially now a numerical damping term, which actually, this modification essentially damping, and so this term here goes to zero as delta x goes to zero. So this is what we call a numerical damping. So in the limit of infinite resolution, that term vanishes. But it has a nice side effect that at finite resolution, it actually damps away the instabilities that arise from the scheme if we didn't have this term included. And so that is a nice property. And just to write this explicitly in conservative form, the modified flux function that we would have is then the following. So we'll have the finite, so the we'll have this expression here actually. Minus one n. And then minus delta x over two delta t. UIN minus UI minus 1N. So that would be the corresponding flux function, a numerical flux function for this modified scheme. And so as I mentioned, so while it has this nice property that it makes the scheme stable, it also smears out discontinuities. So that's not so great. So for example, if you would evolve, say, the Riemann problem in 1D for essentially this initial data, so if this is u and this is x, and so let's say we have, for example, Berger's equation with the flux of the physical flux, 1/2 u squared, then f prime is u. And so we have contractive initial data So on the left-hand side, the signal speed is larger than on the right side. So we'll have a shock forming, and so the shock will propagate in positive x direction. And so after a while, the exact solution will have the shock front at further out here. But if we actually evolve this with the Lax-Friedrich method, then what we would actually get is some sort of smeared out version of this shock front at finite time, which is not what we really want. But it has essentially all the properties in principle that we need, namely it's a conservative scheme, it is stable, and one can also show that it actually satisfies the entropy condition. So it would actually converge to the correct weak solution to the problem. So this is why it will also be always be centered around the actual shock front, but it will not be able to perfectly resolve the shock front due to this dissipative nature of the scheme. And so this is why we have to eventually consider other schemes. And so this will be also part of today's discussion. But before I get there, I wanted to make another important remark, namely, I just wanted to highlight again the importance of the conservative form versus non-conservative form. So we were showing last time that schemes in conservation form actually have this important property that they conserve the conservation nature of the conservation law on the discrete level. And so this is very important, because with that assumption, we were showing the Lax-Wendorf theorem, which told us that if we have such a scheme that preserves conservation of physical quantities on the discrete level, then if the scheme converges, it converges to a weak solution of the problem. And so one can then obviously ask the question, okay, what happens if a scheme is not in this conservative form? So there's a simple example that I wanted to highlight just to illustrate this point a little more, why this Lax-Wendorf theorem is so important, and hence this conservation property on the discrete level. And there's a very simple example, namely if we again look at Burger's equation, and let's assume, yes?
Before we get into this, can I ask a question about the modified form for Lax-Friedrich?
Yeah.
So G was supposed to be something that approximated the integral of F.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so the first two terms seem to satisfy that, but the extra terms that you put in don't have that flavor anymore. So is it still allowed? I mean, according to the definitions and Lipschitz continuous criteria and all of
right.
That
stuff. So you're referring essentially to this part here.
Right.
Yeah. So in terms of these general assumptions of continuity and so on. So that would still hold, because the second term. So if you plug in two identical vectors, right, then the second term will simply vanish. And so it will just pick out the consistency of the first term, and so that is fine. The Lipschitz continuity is also not affected because the second term would satisfy this trivially, I believe. The first term is only Lipschitz continuous if F is Lipschitz continuous, but this is what we essentially started out with. So we started out with that assumption. Now, in order to see how it actually approximates this time integral, that is a good point. So essentially, if there's just advection in the system, right, then the amount of flux that crosses the cell interface would be actually something like UIN, which is already the volume average of the quantity in the cell. And if that's advected, with the advection speed, which will be multiplied on the left, then this also corresponds to some flux through the interface. So one can essentially also think of the second term, or sort of really interpret by sort of appropriately rewriting this here on the right-hand side, also as some approximation of flux through the interface. But yeah, I agree. So this is sort of more complicated to see from this formula, and there's sort of some rewriting needed to actually show that this actually converges to the integral if delta t and delta x go to zero. But yeah, in principle, it does.
I'm happy to take your word for that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions on this before I move on? Okay. So let's see how consider again this difference between a conservative and a non-conservative method. And so essentially the most simple equation, or the most simple case one could look at, is again Burger's equation, where we have this physical flux, 1/2 u squared. And if we assume for now that u is positive, we can just use the simple upwind approximation that we wrote down up here, which will be this one. And so this will be stable, at least according to the CFL condition. So the numerical domain of dependence will include the physical domain of dependence if the CFL factor is chosen accordingly. And so the essentially simplest conservative scheme one could write down in this case is this. And now we have the difference of the fluxes in this upwind fashion. So we have UIN squared minus 1/2 UI minus 1N squared. Now we could also look at this equation in the quasi-linear limit. So where we would just write the equation as ut plus u times ux equals zero. So writing out that spatial derivative explicitly. And we can again discretize this using such an upwind ansatz. And essentially the scheme that we would get is the following. So we'll just approximate u by uin, and then we discretize the derivative again in an upwind fashion. So we have uin minus ui minus 1n divided by delta x. And so now we can actually observe that we can try to rewrite this second scheme in a similar way as the first one. And we'll see that there's one additional term appearing that will make all the difference. So that's rearranged as in this way. And then we'll be left with this expression here. And so this scheme in the quasi-linear way essentially looks like the conservative scheme, except for this additional term here. And so you'll see that this essentially approximates 1/2 delta x and then the first derivative of u squared. And so the problem here, why this scheme behaves differently than the conservative scheme, is because near shocks, essentially the derivative here will not be bounded. So you can see that in smooth, sort of for smooth solutions where we don't have shocks forming and things like that, in principle, the derivative should be bounded. And then if we go to infinite resolution, so
Pardon me, Daniel.
Yeah.
Could you repeat the last maybe 15 seconds you cut out?
Okay, sorry, sure, of course, I will. So I was saying that the two schemes essentially differ in that the second one has this additional term over here, which can be interpreted as a numerical approximation to the first derivative of u squared. And so in smooth, for smooth solutions, for smooth problems where we don't expect discontinuities to form, this derivative ux will be bounded. And so as we go to infinite resolution, so as we let delta x and delta t go to zero, also this additional term here will actually vanish. So in the limit of infinite resolution and for smooth solutions, both schemes will actually be identical. And no matter how you sort of set out the problem and you started the problem, either with a conservation equation or with the quasi-linear version, you will get the same solution. However, if we're dealing with discontinuous solutions, so shocks, then this derivative here is in general not bounded anymore. And so even if you go to infinite resolution of delta x and delta t go to zero, you will still have this term contributing. And so this is why the second scheme here will actually pick out a different solution. So it will not converge to the correct weak solution of the problem. And so for discontinuous problems, the schemes will not be equivalent. So this does not vanish for shocks because ux is not bounded. And this means that there's an extra contribution coming from this term, which if you plug this scheme into the Rankine-Ugnaux conditions, you'll actually get a different shock speed. And so hence the numerical solution here will not approximate the correct weak solution of the problem. So there's actually a nice figure here that I found in Lebesgue's book on finite volume methods. And so he exactly talks about this problem. And I just wanted to highlight this here. So if say, again, we look at discontinuous initial data. So let's look at the Riemann problem again for the Burgers equation. And so we have So actually U has to be greater than zero for the upwind scheme to make sense. So we have something like this. And so this here is our initial data. And so again, since F prime is positive, we have a higher characteristic speed on the left than on the right. So we have a we have convergent compressive initial data that will lead to shock formation. And so the shock front will travel to the right with a speed given by the jump conditions, which is one half the left state plus one half the right state. And so after some time, the exact solution of the problem will look like this. So the shock will have traveled to the right. And so if you have a correct conservative scheme that will then converge to the correct weak solution, you will expect this to approximate this actual shock here. So you might have something like this, right? Or if you have Lux Friedrich, say, you would have something smeared out like this or so. But at least you would expect something that is centered around that shock and that sort of tries to approximate the shock speed in the correct way. Now you discover that if we were using a scheme that is not conservative, it will pick up a wrong shock speed, and it may actually, you know, do something like this, and hence never converge to the actual weak solution of the problem. So this is essentially what's shown here in these figures, where two different methods have been implemented. You see the exact solution as the solid line. And so this is, again, the shock wave after some time. So it has traveled from essentially from zero up to x equals three in this case. So the dots here show the numerical solution of a conservative scheme, in this case, the Goldenhoff type, Goldenhoff scheme, which we'll start to discuss in just a minute. And so that is guaranteed to converge to the correct weak solution of the problem. And then here on the right-hand side, you see this non-conservative method that we just discussed. And you see that it picks up the wrong shock speed. So it still has some sort of, it still keeps some sort of discontinuity, but that one is smeared out to some extent. But more importantly, it has the wrong shock speed. So after some time, you see that the two fronts, the exact front of the actual weak solution differs from the shock front of that scheme. And so this method will not converge to the correct weak solution of the problem. And so this exactly highlights the importance of this conservation property and of the Lax-Wendroff theorem. If we're not using a conservative method, we are by no means guaranteed to find the correct weak solution of the problem. Any questions on this?
So yep. When you're using the conservative methods, do you see like degradation, like when like time advances? Like, do you see like a smooth? Can you round your code like forever? Like, just see the thing propagating, or is it going to eventually like smear out too?
Sorry, can you repeat the last couple of sentences? You sounded a little robotic to me. I'm not sure if that's because of my connection or because of your microphone, but
I don't know. Sorry.
Now it's better.
Okay, so I was wondering if you can run like these conservative codes forever without seeing degradation, or is it it's going to start accumulating? It's going to like break down at some point.
Yeah, great question. So with a conservative scheme, you're guaranteed by the jump conditions to pick up the right shock speed. So whatever happens at later time, your wavefront should still be centered around the correct location of that front. However, your conservative scheme may have also some deficiencies. So it could have some dissipation and things like that. And so gradually, you know, you may see sort of a smearing out. So at some later time, you know, also the Goldenhoff type scheme, so the Goldenhoff scheme is actually also has also some dissipation, and so that will also smear out over time, and so at some later time you also may see some sort of more smeared out shock, but the important property is that it will always pick up the right wave speed. It will always be centered around the correct wave speed. And in the limit of delta t and delta x go to zero, you would still expect this to converge here. So if we ran a series of simulations where we would increase the spatial and hence the time resolution, we would, if you pick out a certain time, you would see a sequence of solutions that would actually, you know, would try to converge to the shock front. So meaning that in the limit of infinite resolution, we would be able to recover that shock front. Although at finite resolution, we will see some degradation over time. But the statement is that essentially a non-conservative method will never be able to do this, unless it's just by chance. But usually it will pick up the wrong shock front. And then even in the limit of delta t, of delta x and delta d go to infinity, you will never be able to recover the correct shock front because the shock speed is wrong to begin with.
So is there a scaling between the mismatch of the speed with delta x?
So that depends on the solution. So essentially, if I go back here, so it is right that usually these correction terms, like in this case here, come with this factor here in front, right? So you suppress this this additional term. But then what you don't control.
Sorry, we've just lost you for about 20 seconds.
Okay, I'm sorry about that. So you're right. So usually these additional terms, come with some resolution dependence. Like here, we have some prefactors like delta x or delta t that suppress this term as we increase the resolution. But the problem we cannot really control is the jump. Is the jump of the derivative, for example, here. And so that can be, arbitrarily large. It's not bounded in general. And so this can completely mess up.
That's probably resolution dependent too, right? So you've got
yes
two factors that are resolution dependent and you would never be able to control that. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, more questions? Okay, if not, then let's move on. Now we talked here a little bit about convergence or non-convergence to a weak solution. But so far, the Lax-Wenderoth theorem only tells us that we converge to some weak solution. But as you know, the weak solutions are not unique. And so to restore uniqueness, we have introduced this concept of entropy. And so the question now is, how can we ensure that with a given scheme, we can actually pick out the correct entropy solution to the problem? Or in other words, what does the scheme need to satisfy for us to ensure that we converge to the entropy condition? And so this leads to the concept of discrete entropy, the discrete entropy condition. And so the idea here is that we can write down a discretized version of the entropy condition that we can check for a given scheme. And so this gives us a handle to check that the scheme actually converges to the entropy solution. So the statement is that if a scheme satisfies this discrete version of the entropy condition, then in the limit of infinite resolution, will be ensured to converge to the entropy solution of the conservation law. So let's say we have some entropy pair for our conservation law. So we usually denote this by phi and psi. And so for this, we need a numerical entropy flux, which we'll denote by capital G. And so this has, as you can see here, the same property. So it must be a continuous function that is also Lipschitz continuous, which is indicated here by this comma one. So an analogy to the numerical flux of the scheme. And it also should have this consistency property that if these two vectors are the same, we actually converge to the physical entropy flux. And so let's say UIN is the solution of the numerical scheme. In conservation form. Discrete entropy condition. And so the entropy condition is the following. And I'll write this already here with this theta parameter in a general form so that we can have an implicit and explicit scheme. Minus G. UIN. So these are the terms at the advanced time step to make it implicit if needed. And here G is, numerical entropy flux scheme is said to be consistent. With the entropy condition, if this discrete entropy condition holds, uniformly for all delta t, delta x as we go to the limit zero. And again, for any entropy pair for any phi ng with this property. And so the sort of attached statement here is, and I will not show this here. The proof is very similar to the Lax-Wendroff theorem, and so this is why I've actually put this on the current problem set as a bonus question for those who are interested to learn more about this. You can just use the methods from the Lax-Wendroff theorem to actually show this statement, namely that if a numerical scheme is in conservation form and it satisfies the entropy, is consistent with the entropy condition, then it actually converges to the entropy solution of the conservation law. So this is just to say that we have a conservative scheme and we assume that the scheme consistent with the entropy condition and the scheme converges to a weak solution. And that's implied by the Lax-Wendroff theorem already, but now it also guarantees that it satisfies the entropy condition. And so this is obviously also of practical use, because in practice, once we write down a scheme, we would then need to show that such a function capital G exists, and that the scheme for any given entropy pair phi and psi would then satisfy this discrete entropy condition. And if it does, we are always guaranteed to find the unique entropy solution that we are actually looking for. So now that may sound a little abstract now, but we'll actually go through this in detail with the Godunov scheme that I'm just about to introduce. So we'll show that the Godunov scheme actually satisfies this discrete entropy condition, and then maybe a few things may become a little clearer. So far, it's just an abstract definition. Do we have any questions on this? Obviously, I should also note that here we're only looking at schemes where we assume they already converge, but convergence is by no means ensured. So the Lax-Wendroff theorem, and then in addition, this discrete entropy condition only tell us what happens for the solution that the scheme converges to. But convergence is by no means ensured. And so for scalar conservation laws, that is usually there are some sufficient criteria depending on the so-called total variation of a solution. So there are certain statements that essentially, if variations of the solution are bounded, then the scheme is stable, and hence being stable and consistent, then it converges. So there are some sufficient criteria for convergence in the 1D scalar case, but actually for nonlinear systems in for nonlinear systems, there are no such statements in general. So one always has to sort of heuristically infer that that one is in a convergent regime for a given problem and a and sort of a given and a given scheme. And so if one has then sort of heuristically verified that, then applying the Lax-Mandrov theorem and the discrete entropy condition then tells us that we are actually getting the correct solution to the problem. Okay, if there are no further questions, then I would start actually introducing the next example. But this is something that we're going to look at in a little more detail because this is essentially one very fundamental scheme for computational fluid dynamics on which essentially most of the modern algorithms are based on. And so this is why I wanted to discuss this in some detail. And this is Godunov's method. So essentially, the idea here is we discussed this Lax-Friedrich scheme earlier. And so the motivation here is to find a conservative scheme that actually does not try to eliminate discontinuities, like Lax-Friedrich, that sort of tries to smear out with this additional dissipation term that guarantees stability. But then tries to eliminate effectively discontinuities. But here we want to try and do exactly the opposite. So instead of trying to cure such discontinuities and such problems, we'll try to make this weakness of such schemes actually a strength of a new scheme that we'll explore here, the so-called Godunov scheme. And that is exactly centered around discontinuities. And this is something that we've already been alluding to a couple of times. This is essentially, the idea is essentially to decompose the evolution of conservation laws into individual Riemann problems in each individual cell. And so this will be a method that is exactly centered around discontinuities. And therefore, by construction, can capture them correctly. And so this is exactly the idea, to turn the weaknesses of other schemes into a strength and center everything and think essentially everything from the point of discontinuities. And then use that as a general method to also attack all sorts of other initial data, smooth problems and everything. So that does not try to eliminate discontinuities. But rather exploits them. And so the basic idea is that of a so-called REA or REA algorithm, and that stands for Reconstruct Evolve and Average. So it will be sort of the main parts of this idea of this algorithm will be from discretized data, we first reconstruct a sort of piecewise polynomial function. And for now, we'll just look at piecewise constant functions as the simplest case. That is, so piecewise constant or piecewise polynomial within a given grid cell. From given cell averages UIN, so from discrete data. So the simplest, as I said, is piecewise constant, and this is also what Godunov originally proposed. So I'll draw a sketch in a second that will illustrate this a little more. So essentially, we'll define this function as piecewise constant, where the constants are given by these cell averages, UIN. Around a given grid point or within a given grid cell. So then we have decomposed essentially our initial data into a piecewise constant function. Now this defines a Riemann problem in each individual cell when these piecewise constant function values are not the same. So we'll have actually individual Riemann problems in each individual cell. So the idea is to evolve the system of conservation laws exactly, or we can also do this approximately with so-called approximate Riemann solvers, something that we'll discuss next week. For now, we'll actually solve these Riemann problems exactly because we know how to do this. And on the current problem set, you'll actually do this in practice. So with this initial data, in each individual cell, so to obtain UN plus one at the next time step, and so this will be a series of Riemann problems. And then finally, we again average the exact function, the exact solution that we find here, and compute cell averages. And then the algorithm can start all over again. And so we'll proceed in this way to get the solution at any finite time t. We can then so this will give rise to the new cell averages from which we can then again reconstruct a piecewise polynomial function, which then will serve as initial data for the Riemann problem at the next time step. And so this is the very basic idea of any such reconstruction, evolve, and average algorithm. So in detail, yeah?
Where exactly are you solving the Riemann problem? Because the Riemann problem needs like a left and a right case. Are you doing between like ui and ui plus one?
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm.
And so how do you take care of that you have a different Riemann problem on either side of the cell?
Yes, so we'll actually define the Riemann problems to be at the center of a given cell. And so then we'll have so in each individual cell, we can then look at the Riemann problem where the initial discontinuity is at the center. And then we'll look at the solution of that Riemann problem in the given cell and make sure that the time step that we evolve is short enough for these nonlinear waves to not cross into the other cells at a given time, so that all these Riemann problems decouple from each other. And so in each individual cell, we can then write down the solution. And then again, we average from one half cell to the next half cell at the next time step to get a new piecewise constant data for the Riemann problem at the cell centers at the next time step. So I'll draw a figure now that will hopefully make this a little more clear. So in more detail. We have some spatial grid of finite volumes. And so in 1D, these will just be intervals I that will be defined in this way. And so if you sort of would essentially, you know, you have the cell averages and piecewise constant data here. So this will be essentially our grid points xi. These will be these cell interfaces. So this will be u and x comma t. So this will be our reconstructed sort of function at step one, where we have a piecewise constant representation in this case of our data. And so this will be essentially what we start with. So, okay, let me just write this down explicitly. So we assume we have some initial data u0 of x given, and this will be some sort of integrable, sometimes smooth, sometimes discontinuous function, but at least we know that the integral should exist. So then we discretize this in the following way, where we compute the cell averages from I minus 1/2 to I plus 1/2. Okay, and so if this is, for example, u naught, this will give us essentially these piecewise constant values here. But sort of then, in general, we can assume at time step n, we have such discretized initial data at time t equals tn. And we assume those to be known. then we as I said, we reconstruct a piecewise constant function which will denote by un x comma tn. That will be uin for x in xi minus 1/2 xi plus 1/2. Now then, and here comes now Boris' point, where is the Riemann problem here? For each cell, we solve the Riemann problem that is posed at the cell interface. So we solve the local Riemann problem which is given by this. And so u of x comma t equals tn will be given by ui n if x is smaller than xi plus 1/2 and ui plus 1n if x is greater than xi plus 1/2. So this would be following situation. So let's say we have, this is xi minus 1, we have xi, and here we have xi plus 1. Now these are the cell interfaces. Those would be xi minus 1/2, xi plus 1/2. And so we have piecewise constant data here. So here, on this state here, we have uin, here we have ui plus 1n, and here we have the constant state e ui minus 1n. And so we have two, so here for example we have the Riemann problems at the two interfaces, and now we can actually analytically compute, or say semi-analytically compute, what the solution is. And so let's say here, for example, we have a left rarefaction wave. We have our contact discontinuity, and maybe let's say the initial data is such that we have a forward shock here in this cell, or say at this cell interface. And say at the other cell interface, we have a two shock solution, for example, something like this. So this would be one and a three shock solution. And so what we then do, so we start off with the reconstructed data, these constant, piecewise constant initial data states. We solve the Riemann problems at the cell interfaces. And then once we did this, we advance to delta t. And then we average the solution that we computed from these two Riemann problems. Again, over this grid cell to get, so this will be average here. And so this will provide us with ui n plus one and similar here. And so on. So this is the idea. And so in order for these Riemann problems not to affect each other, so that we can still decouple them and solve them separately, we need to make sure that these nonlinear ways here don't intersect and don't run into each other. And so this will determine the time step of the scheme. So for all of this to still be decoupled, we need to make sure that these neighboring Riemann problems don't intersect. And I'll derive the condition in a second. So just to sort of graphically point this out here, we need to make sure that sort of none of these solutions crosses into the other cell, or say into the sort of across xi here in a given time step. So if all this decouples, then we obtain the exact, or if we use an approximate Riemann solver, an approximate solution which we'll just call WIN, which is the exact solution in the ith for the ith cell interface. From this, we can then define a global solution to all of these individual Riemann problems by defining a function VN over the entire space, which will just be given by the local Riemann problems in each of the individual, from each of the individual cell interfaces. And so, let me now just quickly derive what the limit on the time step is. So that we can still have this ansatz being valid. So must ensure that neighboring solutions do not influence each other, so that the shock speeds in particular don't run into each other. So we have, we know from if you remember the shock speed from the Rankine-Ugonio conditions satisfies this condition here. So it's bounded by the signal speeds on both sides of the interface. So this would be the shock speeds. We know that they are bounded by these values. Rarefaction waves travel at speeds lambda k of UIN. Do not intersect. So essentially, if you look at this graphically, it is fairly obvious what the condition must be. So say again, here we have the cell interfaces -1/2. This is xi +1/2. And so say we have some wave emanating here from this interface here. Then essentially we don't want this to cross into the Riemann problem of the other that is posed by the other cell interface. So at the next time step. This is delta t. We know that at maximum, it's allowed to travel 1/2 delta x. And if the shock speed is s, then the amount traveled by the shock obviously is s times delta t. And so the condition that we want is that the maximum signal speed times delta t has to be smaller than 1/2 the grid size. So lambda k, the absolute value of lambda k, where k is 1 to m, so any signal speed in our system of equations times delta t has to be smaller or equal than 1/2 delta x. And this looks almost like the CFL condition, and so let's call it the CFL like condition. So this is really the maximum signal speed throughout the domain. And so if we ensure this, those waves will not run into each other. And so finally, we can proceed to the last step and compute new cell averages where we include the Riemann problems from both interfaces and combine them to new initial data for Riemann problems at the next time step. And so this is, so in sort of very explicit fashion, is just, since they decouple, we can just write this as two individual integrals from the two solutions of the Riemann problem at the interfaces xi minus 1/2, xi plus 1/2. Dx, and then essentially everything starts over again. Okay, this is the basic idea of the Godunov scheme that Godunov proposed a few decades ago, that really takes discontinuities at sort of to the heart of the algorithm. And so next time we'll actually show that the scheme that we derived in this way is actually a conservative scheme. So it's not entirely obvious yet that this is the case. So we'll actually show next time that we can derive a flux function, numerical flux function, and recast this idea as a conservative scheme in the way that we defined it previously. And we will then also show that the method satisfies the entropy condition, the discrete entropy condition, and so that the scheme will pick out a unique entropy solution to our problem.